girl I saw, talked to, or touched was her. But my dad likes to say that you can shit in one hand and wish in the other and see which one gets full first. And he's totally right. I've told myself to forget Alex, which shouldn't be all that hard since we've only shared a few sentences, only held gazes for as long as a lightning bug can hold a burn. And I've been doing okay at taking my own advice, with a little bit of Branley's help one weekend when her parents were out of town and Adam wasn't answering his phone. I definitely did not have Alex on my mind when Adam realized he'd missed her calls and I had to run out the back, sweat sticking my t-shirt to my shoulder blades, Branley trying to finger comb the sex bump out of her hair before she answered the door. So I've done a good job of clearing my mind of this girl that I've got no business thinking about anyway when she appears out of the rain. I'm coming around the bend of the sharpest curve in the whole county when I see someone walking, shoulders hunched, and I remember passing a car that had slid off the road a ways back. I slow down so I don't hit them, but I stop because I see that the person is unmistakably female. I would stop anyway, just to be clear, but there's more of an incentive when the rain has plastered her already tight clothing to a very fit body. I swing alongside, roll down the passenger window, and say, "Need some help?" I don't realize it's Alex until she raises her head, dark hair hanging in wet sheets on either side of her face. She looks at me carefully, as if she's trying to remember who I am. It hurts more than I want to admit. And then there's the phantom of a smile. "Jack?" She says it quietly, as if she's either unsure that's my name or like she's been waiting for a chance to talk to me and can't quite comprehend that I'm actually in front of her. I hope like hell it's the second option, because that's exactly how I feel. "Yeah," I say. "You okay?" I realize the second they're out of my mouth, those words are both the last thing I said to her 2 weeks ago and the single most asinine thing I can say to anyone who is drenched and walking away from a broken-down vehicle. I reach across my passenger seat and pop the door. "Want to ride home?" Alex chews her bottom lip for a second, and it kills me because I know she's wondering if she can get in the car with me and not end up in a hole in the woods like her sister. I don't say anything. It's her call. She releases her lip, leaving behind two little white indents, and says, "That would be She stops, searching for a different word. "Convenient." When she gets in the passenger seat, I smell rain and girl and a hint of chemicals. I pull away, all the conversations I'd imagined us having since we talked last leaking out of my brain completely. So I say, "Were you swimming?"
"No. Why would I be?"
"Nothing. It's just you smell like the pool or chlorine or something."
"It's bleach. I'm doing my SYE at the animal shelter, and we clean out the cages on Saturdays. Turn right here."
I break and look for the road, aware that she hasn't given me her address or any real directions to her house. "Here?"
She nods, but is quiet after that. I clear my throat.
"Doesn't PK volunteer at the shelter, too?" Alex wrinkles her nose, sending her freckles into a huddle just on the bridge.
"That's not her real name, is it? I always wondered."
"It's what we call her. PK, because she's the preacher's kid, you know?" Alex nods and looks down at herself.
"These are her clothes. That's why they're so tight on me."
There are about 1,000 sex jokes Park would trot out right now about girls wearing other girls' clothes and naughty overnights. I'm so glad he's not here. But it makes sense to me suddenly why I was so surprised to see Alex's face on the trim silhouette that emerged from the rain. She slipped out of the conscious thought of just about every guy around because she doesn't make herself visible. Other girls push the dress code, showing a solid few inches of cleavage or leggings that hug so tight you don't need an imagination. The cheerleader's skirts are short enough you can easily pinpoint where leg makes the curvy transition into ass. But Alex is different, remarkable because her clothes are utterly nondescript. She wears jeans that give no clue what's underneath and solid color shirts that are all function, not fashion,
Like they've done their job of keeping the wearer from being naked, and that's all that can be expected. I notice these things because in a sea of flesh, all I can look at is Alex's hair swinging as she walks. It's been like that since I saw her face the night I ran away from a dead body in the woods, shame tearing through the high of weed and sex to punch me so hard that I had to stop to catch my breath 50 feet away from that circle of flashlights. 3 years I've been trying to find the right things to say to this girl sitting in my passenger seat, and all that pops out of my idiot mouth is,
"Well, you look nice in PK's clothes."
"I thank you," she says awkwardly, like the words don't quite fit around her tongue. "Turn left."
"You really do." I plow ahead. "I didn't know you were so fit."
It's an incredibly stupid thing to say, but it's also the only thing on my mind. She's put together in a way that seems a little dangerous, all whip thin and muscle. On a guy, that build means he can kick your ass, but he can also lean against a wall and you don't see him until he wants to fuck with you. I don't know what it means on a girl, but I know I like it.
"I run a lot," Alex says. "I like to be outside. Turn left again. It's the third house."
It's pretty much the only one. The other two are abandoned farmhouses with rotting barns splitting like old shoes, ancient bales of straw hanging out of busted haymows. But Alex's house is nice and shiny, the kind that you pick out of a catalog and someone builds in 2 weeks. They're expensive and they look good, but it's good skin with a folding skeleton, a house that will collapse in 40 years while the farmhouses down the road with no windows and sagging porches will stand against the elements for another century. I pull into the driveway, but she stays in the car and looks at me for a second longer than necessary. My heart goes up into my throat.
"Thank you,"
she says again, this time thinking through each syllable so it comes out a little more smoothly.
"That was not
convenient." I interrupt with her word from before and she smiles, the hint of a blush flushing her cheeks.
"I'm sorry," she says, and those words flow out easily, like she says them a lot. "I'm not used to..."
"Talking to boys?" I supply.
"Yes."
"Well, get used to it," I say, and before I even think about what I'm doing, I give her a punch on the arm, which, it turns out, might have been the best thing I could do, because she busts out laughing and punches me back, and it kind of hurts.
Chapter 11. Alex. Sometimes I forget for 1 second, and it hurts. It's a different kind of pain than the constant, the weight that hangs from my heart. It swings from twine embedded so deeply that my aorta has grown around it. Blood pulses past rope in the chambers of my heart, dragging away tiny fibers until my whole body is suffused and pain is all I am and ever can be. But sometimes it swings just right and there's a moment of suspension when I can't feel it. The rope goes slack and the laws of physics give me 1 second of relief. I can laugh and smile and feel something else. But those same laws undo me, and when it swings back, there's a sharp tug on my heart to remind me that I forgot. Anna told me I would understand about boys one day. She said that everything would change, and I would look at them differently, assess their bodies and their words, the way their eyes moved when they talked to me. She said I'd not only want to answer them, but that I'd learn how, knowing which words to use, how to give meaning to a pause. Then a man took her. A man took her before I learned any of these things. He took her and kept her for a while, put things inside of her. Of course, the obvious thing, but also some others, like he was curious if they'd fit. Then he got bored. Then he got creative. Then my sister was gone, and I thought, I understand about boys now. And she was right. Everything did change. I look at them differently, and I assess their bodies, and watch their eyes, and weigh their words. But not in the way she meant. I remember the night Anna left. A casual, "See you later," tossed over her shoulder as I sat in the living room with a book. I grunted in response, having told her a million times before not to talk to me when I was reading. She usually kept chattering until I'd raise my eyes and say, "I'm trying to read." To which she'd mock sympathy and say, "Oh, honey, I thought you knew how. This is so sad." It was a tired joke, one she used every time but somehow made me smile anyway. She didn't trot it out that night, instead making for the back door like she couldn't get out of the house fast enough, which I totally understood. She and Mom had had it out earlier, a real rip-roarer that had centered over whether or not I should go to a month-long poetry camp. Mom was all for it, seeing an opportunity to get me far away from her under the guise of good parenting. Anna said I shouldn't go, that sending me out into the world alone was like letting a wolf loose, and her, my keeper, nowhere near. I was mad at her when she left, even though a part of me knew she was right. Then she was gone, and I unlocked the cage myself. The first time that I acted on my rage, it could have gone very badly, but fate played along with me, and I had my way. I've learned things since then, watched videos with instructors who teach you where to punch, what to pull, things that pop. I'm living my life waiting for the man who comes for me like one did for Anna, with hungry eyes behind the wheel and rope in the trunk. I'm ready, but I don't know how much longer I can wait.
Chapter 12. PK. When I get to school on Friday morning, there's a cop car in the lot, which results in a lot of people hitting the brakes so that they're actually going 20 in the school zone, and more than a few pretending to clean bags of chips and scratch off lottery cards out of their passenger seats and casually walking to the dumpster as if there isn't pot in the gas station bag they're carrying. I cram a couple of empty beer bottles under my driver's seat with my heel while pretending to check my phone for texts after I park. Sarah meets me in the hall with a simple, "What the fuck?" "I don't know," I say. I haven't actually seen the cop anywhere, even though half the student body found a reason to walk past the fishbowl of the office and glance in to see if anybody was standing there in cuffs. The secretary spots me and waves me in, making my heart go up so far in my throat that my eyes probably bulge a bit. "What's up, Karen?" I ask, trying to ignore Sarah miming at me through the window to run for it. The secretary goes to my church, so I'm allowed to call her by her first name, which I admit I kind of lean on for a second, like maybe if I'm really nice to her, she'll hide me under the desk when the cop comes to quiz me about where I was and what I was doing last night. Answer? At Sarah's. Pretty sloshed. "Hey, sweetie pie," she says. "The copier at the church is broken again, so I ran off the bulletins here. Could you get these to your dad?" My mouth twitches when she holds up her own bag from the gas station, straining against the huge stack of paper inside. "Don't tell anybody," she stage whispers at me when I take it. "Technically, I'm using school supplies for the church." "I doubt that fast tracks you to hell," I say before I can reconsider my language. She laughs a little, her rhinestone-encrusted glasses moving up on her face about an inch as her nose crinkles. "Hey, Karen," I say, since we're being conspiratorial, "what's with the cop car?" "Drug assembly," she says. "You know." She holds her fingers up to her mouth and totally surprises me by using the right indication for pot instead of a cigarette. "We'll be on a one-hour delay schedule. Everyone will go to the auditorium first thing. The principal will make an announcement soon, but you've got a hot tip so you can get a good seat." I tell Sarah what's up as we head to our lockers, the promised announcement drawing groans from the kids in the hall. "Why can't you have connections that can get us a hot tip for good seats to a Reds game?" Sarah asks. "I'll see if they have a Lutheran night or something coming up," I tell her, and she elbows me. "What's in the bag?" I lean in a little closer to her than necessary when I answer. Carrying around church bulletins at school is not going to break me out of the preacher's kid label anytime soon. Sarah's trying not to laugh at me when Branley's very bronzed, perfectly smooth shoulder knocks into mine, hard enough to send the bag flying out of my hands. 100 copies of the Lord's Prayer and next week's hymn numbers spreading out in a fan down the hall. "Sorry," Branley says. She's on her knees restacking bulletins before she even looks up to see who she obliterated with her bony knob. Her eyes meet mine as I start scraping piles of paper into the bag, not caring that a bunch are getting bent. "Oh," she says, her hands freezing. "Sorry," she mutters again, before her similarly tanned friend Lila pulls her to her feet, and they head off toward the auditorium. Sarah helps me with what's left, and we're the last kids in the hall. Someone is tapping the microphone in the auditorium, the knock-knock sound filling our ears as we turn the corner to the double doors. Branley and Lila are standing in the doorway, heads craning as they look around the darkened room for the rest of the in-crowd. "What's going on?" I didn't hear Alex come up behind me, so I jump when she asks, drawing the attention of the teachers lining the back wall. "Come on, girls, let's go," Miss Hendricks says, shepherding me, Sarah, Alex, Branley, and Lila up to the front row, the only place there are 5 seats left. "Good seats, sweet," Sarah hisses in my ear. "Shut up," I say, settling in with Sarah on one side of me and Alex on the other. At least I didn't end up next to Branley, both of us trying not to share an armrest or keep our legs from touching the entire time. The principal takes the podium and tells us about how a member of the local police is here to give an important presentation and reminds us that we're representing our school. He trots out a few more stock phrases that none of us even hears anymore. We politely clap as the officer comes out, a few girls paying more attention once we get a good look at him. He's got the clean-cut thing going on, a good jawline, and the kind of body that makes me wonder if they actually rented him from somewhere. But he's wearing a gun and walks like he's taking each step really seriously, so I'm pretty sure he's a legit cop. He takes the microphone off the podium and walks to the middle of the stage so we can see his whole body. No dumbass, this one. "Hey, I'm Marilee Nolan's brother," he says, instead of introducing himself as Officer Nolan, which is smart since we were all going to surreptitiously text one another until we figured out why he looked familiar anyway. Over in the right wing, Marilee buries her face in her hands, which I totally get because I feel the same way every graduation when my dad blesses the senior class. "I graduated from here 8 years ago," he says. "Back then, the rough kids smoked pot, and the National Honor Society kids drank. Now, the NHS kids are smoking pot, and the rough ones are on heroin." There are a couple of giggles. Sarah leans over to whisper in my ear, "And the preacher's kid drinks," to which I say, "Damn straight," and give her a fist bump. "Here's the thing, guys," Nolan goes on. "I'm supposed to come in here and talk to you about drugs, but I'm guessing most of you already know plenty." It's really quiet in the auditorium. Nolan doesn't have notes. The big screen is pulled down and there's a laptop on the podium, but he's not showing us pictures of meth teeth or heroin sores like we expected. He's just talking to us, and we're listening. "I know a lot of you drink," he says, and Marilee's head goes a little farther down in her hands. My cheeks are burning for her because this is way worse than Dad saying a prayer over a bunch of teenagers. "I know because I did it, and I know because I find all the Natty Light cans out on 27. There are more than a few concerned glances shared at that point. Drinking out on County Road 27 was definitely something we thought flew under the radar. "So you're drinking. No big deal," Nolan says. "Except, maybe it is. Not because you're under 21 and it's illegal, but because of what happens next." I expect the slides to start up then. Pictures of ruined kidneys or maybe a car crash where someone went through a windshield. But the screen stays blank, and Nolan's eyes land on the front row instead. "What happens next is you're more likely to be a victim of sexual assault," he says, and I feel Alex tense beside me. "Girls, 1 in 3 of you." He points right at me, Alex, Sarah, Branley, and Lila. There are five right here, so let's be generous and say it's just one. Which one of you will it be? From the left, a boy yells, "Please say it's Branly," followed by a chorus of laughter. "Let me guess, she's the hot one, right?" Nolan says, smiling along with them. "Guess what? One of you is the one who's going to do it." That shuts it down fast. "It's a small town," he goes on. 90% of rapes are acquaintance rapes. That means you know your attacker, girls. And guys, that means you know the girl you damaged physically, emotionally, and mentally. 1 in 6 of you boys is going to be sexually assaulted too, by the way. And that really kills the room. "Boys are also more likely to OD than girls," Nolan says, his eyes off us and narrowing in on Jack Fisher and his friends. "You're also twice as likely to die in a car crash, a full quarter of which was your own damn fault because you were drinking at the time." The principal clears his throat at the use of the word damn, which I think is kind of ridiculous considering it's the least alarming thing we've heard since Nolan opened his mouth. "And here's the thing," he says. "We can't do anything about that unless you report it. We can't stop your friends from driving drunk and killing themselves or someone else unless we know they're behind that wheel ahead of time. Girls, we can't prosecute that guy who spiked your drink unless you tell us it happened. And you don't want to. I get it. It's a small town. The person behind the wheel is your buddy. The person who touched you is your best friend's cousin, is your parents' coworker, is someone everybody trusts, so no one is going to believe you. But I'll believe you." The room is so quiet, I swear you can hear people weighing their options. "The truth will always out," Nolan says, his gaze heavy on the crowd. "And I, and the rest of the department, will see justice served." "What about Comstock?" a boy yells out. "If you guys never found out who did him in." There's a spatter of laughter, and some murmured agreements, but Nolan rolls with it, absorbing the slam. "I know, right? Only 2 murders ever committed in this town, and we haven't solved either of them." Sarah leans into me. "I thought Comstock was arrested for..." She trails off, nodding toward Alex instead of finishing her sentence. I shake my head. "He was arrested but never charged. Not enough evidence. They had to release him, and that's when..." I draw my finger across my throat, although there was more to it than that. A lot more. "Yep," Nolan goes on. "Pretty funny, right? The cops can't put a guy away, so someone else takes care of it. Serves justice on their own terms."
"Hell yes,"
comes a call from the audience.
"Kinda cool," Nolan nods, "until you actually think about it. I'm assuming I don't have to tell you what happened to Comstock."
He doesn't. It's the stuff of slumber party talk. The kind of party where nobody sleeps well.
"Think about it for a second," he says. "There's someone out there who can do that. They're loose. They're among us. And they'll do it again. Hilarious, right?"
Yeah, nobody's laughing. We're all pillars of cement in our chairs. Except Alex, who I notice is lounged back, looking at Nolan the same way dogs do when they take each other's measure. I guess hearing someone say they don't heartily agree with what happened to Comstock might be kind of hard to take. The screen behind Nolan suddenly lights up, the only thing on it an email address and phone number.
"That's my info," Nolan says. "I knew if I said come up and get business cards, half of the people who wanted to wouldn't, and half of those who did would toss them 5 minutes later. So, get out your phones and take a pic. Everybody. Right now."
We do. All of us. There's a wave of movement across the auditorium and a bunch of camera clicks in stereo. I'm willing to bet some of the girls are going to use Nolan's number for reasons other than reporting underage drinking and sex crimes. But it's cool that we've got this moment, everyone with their phones in the air. Except Alex. I look over at her and she shrugs. "I don't have a phone," she says. "I'll email it to you," I tell her, and she shrugs again. I think about reaching over and taking her hand, or rubbing her shoulder. Something to show my solidarity with her over the fact that right now, everyone in this room is thinking about her dead sister. But I don't. Because much like a strange dog, I'm not sure if she'll bite me when I do.
Chapter 13. Alex. We all walk out of the auditorium into the bright lights of the hall, blinking. It's a harsh awakening that breaks the spell the cop managed to weave, quieting constantly running mouths and forever lit up phones. In the anonymous dark, the air was heavy with thoughts. The blonde girl sitting next to me fighting to breathe normally when a boy suggested she'd be the one raped of the five of us who were called out. Out here in the light, it's harder for her to hide how badly that upset her. Her face is tight, her smile stretched too thin, and she pretends to have a wayward hair in her eye that explains the pooling tears. The light is taking a toll on all of us. The deeply personal thoughts brought on by darkness whisked away as someone makes a joke, and then another, and soon all anyone wants to know is what's for lunch. Not who will be a victim and who a perpetrator. A hand clamps on my arm, and I jerk away immediately, down and with a twist, so that they can't keep their grip. "Whoa, hey, sorry," a male voice says. Jack is right in front of me, and I have to focus on stringing together the right words in order to seem normal. "Are you okay?" he asks when I don't say anything. "You're always asking me that," I say, and part of me wonders if that's because he instinctively knows I am definitely not. "No, I mean," he brushes his hand through his hair. "That assembly, it was pretty fucked up. Sorry." I don't know if he's saying that he's sorry that he swore, or that he's sorry I had to sit through that, or if he's sorry that he scared me when he grabbed my arm. I'm cradling the wrist that he touched, holding it against my chest because where our skin met burns so badly, I'm sure it's blistering, and I don't want him to see how hard my heart is beating. "Did I hurt you?" he asks, eyes on my hands. "No," I say. I stop talking because I don't know what I am. "Good, because I wouldn't do that. Hurt someone, I mean." His eyes have moved up to mine, and they're so honest, I have to wonder what mine look like to him. "You or anybody else," he adds. "You can't know that." I say the first thing that comes to my mind, a reactionary cog setting another in motion. It's impossible to know what any one of us will do in a given situation, especially intense ones. His friends are gathering at the end of the hall, looking back at us. The blonde girl calls his name, and he waves at them to go on, drawing a pout from her as the second period bell rings. He walks with me to class like it's a normal thing, and I let it feel that way, too, for a moment. "Alex Kraft," he says. "I think every situation with you is an intense one." I feel a smile on my face, muscles that haven't twisted in that manner since I talked to him last, shaking with the oddity of it. An answering smile echoes on Jack's face, and I can see laugh lines forming around his lips. A life only starting, but already well-lived. "Anyway," he goes on, "I don't want you to be upset about what the cop was saying about the person who, well, you know, about there being a killer out there and that they'll do it again." I settle for smiling as we part, instead of answering, because the only words I have are, "The cop is right," and it doesn't upset me at all.
Chapter 14. PK. "Best assembly ever," Sarah says as she gets in my passenger seat. Her basketball conditioning was canceled, so she's bumming a ride, and probably dinner, off me. "People were either going to cry or start punching each other," she says. "Loved it." "I felt bad for Alex," I say. "What's her deal anyway?" "I don't know," I tell her honestly, flipping off the car full of junior boys who are riding my ass. I'm not sure she so much has a deal as she just minds her own business. Yeah, small town, no such thing, Sarah says. Take it from the lesbian contingent of one. You're not the only lesbian in town, I tell her for the 100th time. Do me a solid and let me know when you spot another one, she says as I pull into my driveway. Sarah cranes her head to look at the bell tower, as always. I'm so used to growing up next to the church I don't even see it anymore. Don't think about the massive graveyard that I live next to, either. Giving people directions to my house has always been easy. Drive out of town on the state route until you're in the middle of nowhere and suddenly there's a huge church. I live next to it. Easy to locate, sure. Easy to pretend not to be the preacher's kid when you use the steeple as a navigational point? Not so much. I grab the bag of bulletins from the back seat and we go inside. Mom and Dad are sitting at the dining room table, trying to look like they haven't been waiting on me, which immediately sends out warning signals. What? I ask before I even put the bulletins down. Sarah, Mom says, walking toward her for a huge hug. Good to see you. Sarah hugs her back but repeats my question when she steps away. Yeah, sorry, PK's parents, but definitely what? My dad doesn't go in for a hug on either of us, but gives us both an awkward smile. We heard you had an assembly today. Sarah and I both make half-vomit noises. Was there some kind of parental alert call system that kicked in? I ask. Do I need to go? Sarah asks. No, it's probably best if you hear this too, my dad says as he ushers us into the living room, my mom following with glasses full of iced tea that have been poured for a while now because they're sweating like crazy. Mom and Dad sit on the couch. Sarah and I take the love seat, and we all look at each other. So, what did you think about the assembly? Mom finally asks. I share a glance with Sarah, who makes her eyes really big and takes a huge sip of iced tea. Lots of help there. It was kind of scary, you know. Dad surprises me by saying, good. He goes on. Sorry, honey. The truth is often alarming. I've been fielding phone calls all day from parents, and I've been telling them the same thing. I understand you were one of the girls the officer pointed to when he mentioned rape statistics. Yeah, I say, the one word catching in my suddenly dry throat. Me and Sarah both. Were people pissed off about that? Some, Dad says. Apparently, Branley Jacobs' mom called the school and gave the principal an earful over it. I think Branley was kind of upset, Sarah says. Somebody made a joke and... She stirs her tea. I don't know if she was crying or anything like that, but she sure wasn't laughing. How did you feel about it, honey? Mom asks me. I don't know, I tell her. I wasn't, like, pissed off or anything, but it was weird. I mean, we hear numbers like that shit. Oops, sorry. We hear statistics like that all the time. But when he actually pointed at five of us, it made it real, my dad says, nodding. Yeah, like, really real. That's what your father said to the parents who have been calling, Mom says. If we have to hit you over the head with a sledgehammer to make you be careful, then I'll be the first one in line at the hardware store. I don't want you to walk around scared, Dad says, eyes sliding over to Sarah. Either of you. But things aren't good around here. There's never been a lot of money in this county, but times are tighter than ever, and poverty breeds desperation. People look for escape in different ways, through drugs, through alcohol, and through sex. My hands leave my glass to cover my face. I'm sorry, honey, but it's true, Dad says. You were doing great until you said sex, I tell him. My words muffled by my fingers. Now I can't look at you. For the record, me neither, comes Sarah's similarly muted voice beside me. We'll keep talking, but you don't have to look at us, okay? Dad says. I nod, and I feel Sarah doing the same thing beside me.
I don't know how much you know, Dad says, giving me a little pause where I can feel free to volunteer all my sins if I feel so inclined. I don't. There's been an influx of heroin in the county. Bad heroin, Mom clarifies, and I know Sarah is trying just as hard as I am not to laugh at the idea that apparently she classifies some heroin as good. A handful of people overdosed last week, Dad goes on. It's out there, along with meth, which in some ways is even more dangerous because people are trying to make it themselves. Cook it, Mom corrects. And I have to wonder if they went to some kind of seminar or something where buzzwords were printed on PowerPoint slides in italics. We're not stupid. We know you drink, Mom says. And I am so damn grateful my head is already down. We know what it's like growing up here, honey. We did it too. But neither one of us was ever the preacher's kid. And I know that's not easy for you, Dad adds. I want you to have a normal high school experience without that defining you. But you're also my daughter, and I'm just a dad who wants his girl to be safe. I am safe, Dad, I say. And part of me wants to keep my face covered, and part of me wants him to know that I didn't start crying until this moment, and embarrassment has shit to do with it. Sarah, Dad clears his throat. This applies to you, too. Just because you're not interested in boys doesn't mean they're not interested in you. Oh, sweet baby Jesus, Sarah says into her hands. Girls, Dad says, if either one of you is ever in a situation you're not entirely comfortable with, call me. I don't care what time it is, I don't care who is there or what is going on. You call me and I will come get you. I'm totally crying now, and I don't even care. I look up at my dad and he's crying too. My mom's got her hand on his knee like she's the only thing keeping him attached to the world. Baby girl, Dad says, there's nothing you can ever do that will make you unwelcome in my house. I nod, a few tears falling into my lap when I do. Sarah's still got her face covered. Mom takes my glass to refill it, and Dad goes to get some tissues. Sarah looks over at me and wipes her eyes. You've got the best parents in the fucking world, she says.
Chapter 15. Alex. It's dark when I get home, even though the sun is still up. Our windows stay closed, our curtains drawn. It's easier for Mom to ignore the outside world this way. Out of sight, out of mind. The only thing perpetually in her line of vision, a bottle of scotch. I put myself in her way accidentally, our paths crossing in the kitchen as I get a glass of water. She looks up at the clock, confused. You're home? School lets out at 3, Mom. Her eyes thin out as she squints at the clock, the shakily applied eyeliner she puts on only for herself, crimping together as she does. It's 3:30, I supply. Oh. She busies herself for a few minutes, trying to make it seem like she came into the kitchen for something other than to refill her glass. I wait her out patiently, sipping my water and crunching ice between my teeth. How is school? I imagine this question is asked all over the world, every day, receiving everything from flippant answers to in-depth reckonings. But it's hardly ever asked here, in this house. The last time I answered this question, I was wearing a Hello Kitty book bag, and the heels of my shoes lit up when I walked. I pulverized some ice with my molars while I think. I could tell her, I suppose, let her know that Anna was on the minds of everyone today. Something that rightfully belongs to only us, resurrected once again as a cautionary fairy tale, a warning to all the Little Red Riding Hoods that there are wolves in the forest. I could tell her, but I don't. Because I know why the curtains are drawn and the windows are shut. Nothing is ours. Nothing is sacred. The one thing we shared was pulled into pieces, memorialized and mythologized so that everyone could participate in it. When she was missing, Anna's picture was tacked in so many places around town. It's what I see when I think of her, not her actual face. I see that picture next to a lost cat poster and a lawn mowing service advertisement. I learn later they did find that cat. School was fine, I say, and dump the rest of my water in the sink.
Chapter 16. PK. We're cleaning cat ears. Rhonda doesn't require us to come in on Sundays, but somebody has to feed the animals. Yesterday, Alex and I helped 5 cats and 2 dogs find homes, one of them being the newly spayed Dump, who was pretty cute once she got cleaned up. We agreed we probably could have placed a couple more cats if their ears were nice and pink inside, like in the wet food commercials. We told Rhonda to take a much-deserved break today, and we'd come in, feed everybody, and make our cats a little more like the ones you see on TV. So, I skipped church to clean cat ears. Normally that wouldn't fly, but since we had a half-mortifying, half-heartwarming family moment Friday, Dad was okay with it. It's kind of a gross job. A lot of these guys come in here with ear mites. They get this nasty black buildup that has its own special smell if it's been sitting in their ear canals a while. It doesn't matter how much I wash my hands, I can still smell it hours later like an onion. And cats don't exactly love having their ears cleaned, so it takes 2 people. Alex has this weird hypnotic effect on them. I wrap them up in towels, bundled tight like cat burritos in my arms, and then Alex talks to them, low and soft. I don't know if she relaxes them or if it's more like utter defeat because they know they've come up against an unstoppable force of the Q-tip, but they go limp after a few minutes. When she's done, she'll nod at me and I let them go. They stalk off with their ears down and their tails in the air, trying to regain whatever dignity we took from them. It's a close work environment. Alex leans over the cats while I've got them tucked under my arm like a football. She smells like cold air and the late evening showers that are 2 degrees away from being snow. "What are you wearing?" I ask. She grunts something that might be a question, her usual word choice lost in concentration as she digs into a Tom's ear. "Perfume? Body spray? You smell good," I clarify as her confusion deepens. "I suppose it could be my shampoo," she says as she squirts medicine into the Tom's ear, massaging it down into the canal. Inexplicably, he purrs. "It was raining earlier, and I jogged here." "Wet hair smells," she adds, as if this statement is nothing odd. He's done. I unwrap the Tom and he jumps down, leaving us empty-handed and looking at each other. "What do you mean you jogged here? It was almost snowing this morning." "My car is in the ditch," she says, like it's been casually misplaced. "Are you okay? Did you get hurt?" "It was last weekend. I'm fine." "Okay." I look at her for a second, unsure how much I get to pry now that we've shared lunch meat through a fence. I don't ask why she didn't get her mom to bring her, because I consider other people's parents an out-of-bounds topic. I've been picked on enough about mine. "Do you want a ride home or something?" I ask slowly, not sure if I'm even supposed to offer. If Alex says no, then it's a very clear statement. She'd rather run home in cold weather than have our friendship move any further. She puts the unused Q-tips back in the box one at a time while she deliberates. "Yes, that would be nice." "Cool. What's your name?" "What?" She said my name before. I know it. I remember because it came out funny, like she was stumbling a little with it. But Alex licks her lips as if they've gotten dry from this new experience of talking so much and repeats herself. "What's your name?" "PK." Alex shakes her head and sprays down the counter, sending fluff from every disgruntled cat we've worked on today flying into the air. Tiny black, gray, white, and ginger hair settle onto the floor before she tries again. "That's not your name. It's what people call you." "It's my nickname," I say, an edge of defensiveness sneaking into my tone. "It stands for..." "I'm aware of what it stands for. I'd like to know your name." Alex holds eye contact, almost always. Even when she says insignificant things like, "Is it my turn to clean the toilet or yours?" It's like the fate of the world hangs in the balance. So when she's staring me down over a stainless steel table asking me what my name is, I feel a weird bump in my throat. Like, maybe it actually is important. I clear my throat to make room for the answer. "Claire. My name is Claire." Her smile breaks out, ear to ear, infectious as hell. "That's a lovely name. I would go by that if I were you." I drop my eyes. "People have always just called me PK." And I let them. Even though maybe in the beginning it wasn't meant to be nice. Maybe in the beginning there was a taunt underneath it, an edge born on the playground that supposedly matured into affection. But maybe it didn't. Maybe it was a constant affirmation of who I'm supposed to be, said into my face every day to remind me of my place. Maybe when I sucked Adam's dick and he said my name at the end, it wasn't just because he wanted me, but because he just got a blowjob from the preacher's kid, Alex says. "Yeah," I say, feeling that stupid bump again. "I'm the preacher's kid. I'm the girl with the dead sister." "I'm sorry about that," I say quickly, and she cocks her head exactly like one of the dogs. "The first day when I called you..." "Anna," she waves it off. It's understandable. Sometimes it's how I perceive myself, too. I laugh a little, and the bubble in my throat pops. "Why do you talk so funny?" Alex doesn't hesitate. The answer is right on her lips, like she's had it prepped in anticipation. I read a lot. I don't have a lot of experience in conversation, so my turn of phrase is different from... "Pretty much everybody else, yeah," I finish. "Don't you pick it up, though? Like in the hallways or whatever?" I try not to listen. I can dig that. I've overheard things I definitely wish I hadn't. I suddenly remember Branley, her shiny, waxed legs stretched out in front of her while she talked about Alex loud enough to be heard, shooting snide glances and waiting for her to take the bait. And Alex reading Dostoevsky like it was nothing, her own world blossoming around her. Her own world, population one. When we get into my car, I jack the heater up, the stale air blowing out of the vents and fanning Alex's hair away from her face. She gives me directions to her house, and I flip off her car, resting in the ditch when we pass it. She actually laughs at that. It's funny to hear such a natural sound when her conversation comes out so stilted. As soon as I think it, I hear my mom's Sunday school teacher voice in my head, about how a smile is the same in every language. I guess that goes for laughing with the socially awkward, too. I sneak a glance at her when I pull into the driveway. We kept the conversation on the drive to shelter talk, who we hoped would get adopted next, and Rhonda's creative non-swearing insults. Friend Eater is my current favorite. Alex likes Sweater Unraveler. I put the car in park and open my center console to grab the last senior picture I have. It's an awkward pose, the one I liked the least. I'm leaning against the stone wall at the local park, my mouth stuck in a grimace that suggests I'm at the end of my shoot and patience at the same time. Mom loved this one, a traditional shot that she ordered more of than necessary. The pose I pawned off on freshmen who asked if they could have one. "Hey, want one of my pictures?" I ask impulsively, and Alex pauses, her hand ready to unlock the passenger door. She thinks about it a second, as if accepting it might mean taking an irreversible step. And maybe for her it kind of is. "Yes," she says. I take a pen off the dash, turquoise ink, and am about to scribble PK and our graduation year on the back, but I stop. Instead, I twist the pen in my fingers for a second, the unfamiliarity of writing my given name making my hand awkward. It actually takes concentration for me to write it in cursive, the handwriting shaky and childish. But Alex smiles when she accepts it, and nods when I tell her I'll see her in school on Monday. And the truth is, I'm kind of looking forward to it.
Chapter 17. Jack. I'm in bed with Branley again. She dragged me upstairs, even though I was so drunk, I didn't think it would be worth her effort. But the girl knows me, and while the party music from downstairs pumps so loud I can feel it vibrating the floor in Park's bedroom, Branley climbs on top and does what she wants. She's over the top, with a push-up bra and her hair a wild mess, while she makes noises straight out of low-budget porn. I'm man enough to know I shouldn't let her do this shit to me, but enough of a boy to be completely turned on. She shrieks dramatically and falls forward, heavy and panting onto my chest. I let my eyes slide closed as her breathing evens out and the dark clouds of unconsciousness gather in my brain. I'm fading, but I know that my mouth is hanging open and I might have just snored a little when Branley starts drawing little circles on my chest with her finger. Tickles, I mutter, shoving her hand away. Fine. She rolls on to the other pillow. I don't need to look to know she's pouting. I'm supposed to do something now. Reach out, tell her I'm sorry, touch her hair. Instead, I ask her where her boyfriend is.
What?
She sits up, her necklace pooling in her cleavage.
Why?
I shake my head and can't pinpoint exactly when it stops moving.
I said, why?
Branley shoves me. Jesus Christ. Because maybe we shouldn't be doing this, okay? The words smell like everything I've drunk, mixed with stomach acid. How do you not get that? An easy smile, a Branley smile, slides across her face.
But this is what we do.
Maybe not anymore. She leans in, the necklace swinging away from her chest and slipping down to touch mine.
As long as there's a maybe,
she whispers, and then her mouth isn't talking anymore, and all I can think is, why'd you say maybe, dumbass? But I know why. It's because I'm addicted to her, and have been ever since we discovered things together in junior high, all sloppy and confused in the back seat of her brother's car. She's gotten a lot better since then, and I'm still a drunk idiot fumbling in the dark. And it is dark, and I am drunk. It's so dark that Branley's hair isn't catching much light when her face hovers near me. It could be any color as it cascades around us. Not the blonde I'm so used to seeing splayed across the pillow, but dark, like the strands that were left behind on my passenger seat. I'm so drunk that when I touch skin, all I have to do is imagine freckles, and they might as well be there. And then they are. They just are. And I pull her down to me and roll onto her, wishing the smell of rain and cold air into the room with a misfiring of a synapse. We're skin to skin, and I'm into this with an urgency that didn't exist before, and she's making noises I've never heard. Never heard because they've always been practiced and perfect, and I've taken her by surprise. She's loving it, and I am too. But I'm not just in it for the fuck right now. I want this. I want her. I want to see the smile that flashed ever so briefly at me in the hall the other day. I want... Alex. Her name slips through my teeth as I collapse, utterly spent and crushing her. Crushing Branley.
What the fuck?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Bran. I'm so, so sorry. And I am, because that was shitty as hell. Branley shoves me away and rips through the covers looking for her clothes. How could it be so dark in here a few minutes ago I could let that happen, but now be damningly light, light enough to see that she's crying? Branley, wait, I say, reaching for her hands, trying to stop her as she struggles into her jeans. But she's saying only one word over and over.
No, 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 no. You don't do that to me. I'm Branley Jacobs. Do you understand that? Branley Jacobs.
She says her own name the way most of the guys do, a mix of how the hell can that even exist, and can I make it mine?
Guys fuck other girls and think of me, she says, not the other way around. You're an asshole, Jack Fisher, a real fucking asshole.
She slams the door so hard I feel the reverberations in my spine.
I collapse back onto the bed, and for the first time in a long time, Branley has my undivided attention, because I think she might be right.
Chapter 18. Alex. I never thought it would be Jack Fisher. In third grade, our class went on a field trip to the state park. We were at the end of a hike, the last 100 feet or so impossibly angled and difficult. Most of the kids and all the teachers were taking the stairs, gripping onto the rails, holding hands, and saying encouraging things to one another about almost being there. I left the trail, not wanting to move at their pace. I climbed the hill on my own, reaching for tree branches and pulling myself forward, feeling a deep burn in my calves and loving the half-second of panic every time I slipped a little. I passed Jack and Branley as they picked their way up the stairs, him carrying her little plastic bag of whatever she'd bought for herself at the gift shop. I remember the slightest trace of impatience on his face as he offered Branley an arm, pulling her up where a step had been washed out. Our gazes met as I moved past them, ripped hands and filthy knees making my own way, and I saw a flash of envy, quickly stifled. And I knew that he'd rather be off the path with me, moving quickly, tearing his clothes. But he stayed where he was, and I heard another boy's voice behind me. "It ain't easy, but it sure is faster," he said, just as he lost his foothold. My arm shot out, and he grabbed for me instinctively, and I steadied him until he got a firm grip on a tree trunk. We climbed up together, passing our classmates and ignoring the adults who yelled at us that we were going to break our necks. Sweat dripped off our foreheads, cutting clean tracks through the dirt on our faces, but we beat everyone to the top, breaking out of the shade and into the light. We looked at each other, and he said, "I have a tree frog in my pocket. Don't tell anyone." I promised I wouldn't, and we huddled together in the back of the bus on the way home, marveling over the little creature. We fell into the habit of meeting each other outside at recess, climbing trees and wading in mud puddles, not worried about getting dirty. His name was Mike, and he came to school dirty anyway. Mike was gone the next year. I stood on the playground on the first day of fourth grade, looking for the only person I called my friend, and he wasn't there. I think he was the first boy I ever noticed. And now, Jack Fisher has my attention. Jack, who I always thought was like everyone else, loud and boring. Jack, who is more intelligent than I gave him credit for. Jack, who looks like he has something he desperately wants to say to me and doesn't know how. Jack, who wouldn't leave the trail to follow me when we were little. Maybe now he will.
Chapter 19. PK. It's like Adam and Branley got married over the weekend, and now we all get to watch the honeymoon. "She'll be pregnant by fourth period at this rate," Sarah says, tossing her books onto the desk. "I mean, I don't know if you saw, but he had her pressed up against..." "I saw," I said a little too sharply. Everyone in the room looks at me, and I realize how nasty I must have sounded, because I even have Alex's attention. I lower my voice. "Sorry," I tell Sarah, "it's just not cool." She nods and touches my hand, but I hardly feel it. I might as well still be out in the hallway, watching Branley drape herself all over my boyfriend. Ex-boyfriend, damn it. Adam was always casual with me. Some hand-holding at lunch, a peck on the cheek in between classes, a tossed, "See ya, babe," as we walked out of school. Branley, he can't get enough of. Branley, he touches constantly. Branley, he won't be separated from. Branley walks into the classroom, reapplying her lipstick, because it's all been kissed off by my boyfriend. And I'm going for her. There's no logic involved. No weighing of pros and cons or thought of consequences. I smack the lipstick out of her hand just as it reaches her lips, and she yelps in surprise. Violence in real life is not the streamlined performance art of movies. It's not sexy. It's awkward and confusing. Branley just looks at me. Like maybe there's been some kind of mistake. Some weird blip in physics that made my hand hit hers and makeup fly across the room. What was that? She asks, and I see a smear of glittery pink across her front teeth where the lipstick dug in a little.